Shane, if I can start with you, it would be great to kind of get your perspective from an IBM point of view, what you sort of saw coming out of Glasgow. And does this give you hope for the future?
The first big thing that I think we all recognize is this is our time. This is our decade. And it's the professionals actually working today, like you, Michael, me, Richard, those people leading in industry that are going to basically determine the future of the planet. And it's our responsibility really to do that for the next generation, for our kids and the generations beyond that. And if we don't act now, if we don't deal with the problem, there won't be the future for the generations to come. I also think what is absolutely clear is within real estate, we have a huge responsibility to really have leadership in this space. We emit about 40% of the world's CO2 globally. So we have a deep responsibility to act and to lead in this particular area. Now, what I particularly liked around the buzz up at COP26 was effectively the questions that were being asked around the validity of carbon offsets. And I think this is actually a really, really important point, because I think whatever we do now within industry, however we lead within real estate, we have to do it in a very credible and transparent way. And I think, you know, we need to be talking about what we're actually emitting and what we're actually consuming. And I think that's something that, you know, I'm very proud to say here at IBM, we've been doing this for decades and thoroughly have at the heart of our policy and the way that we drive our initiatives. Offsets have been valuable in the past, but I think we now need to get down. We need to be dealing with actually what it is that we're doing to the environment and properly addressing it, as I say, through transparency and through credible measures.
We've known, of course, that some personalities have issues with really working in the open office. We all have some kind of need for shelter and a bit of privacy from our evolutionary days. But we see that some people have a harder time working in an open environment than others. So we looked at this, of course, the type of enclosure and also how crowded it is, and not only how many workplaces are there, but also are they all occupied. And surprisingly, I guess, we found that it's actually more how crowded it is than how much space you really have. Yeah, people don't mind working in an open area as long as it's not too big and there's not too many people working there at the same time. So I think that that's an important takeaway for the offices with very large open floors, that the idea of that you stimulate communication that way is not really proven, or actually it's more proven that it doesn't really happen at a longer distance on the floor anyway. But the perception on a health level, on a well-being level, is very negative from such a large open area. So yeah, we try to look at it that way as well.
Are you saying that the data you've collected shows that a large open floor plate is, even if it's not crowded, is not conducive to good quality work?
In my PhD, which was not about health, but only about knowledge sharing, I already found evidence that you have to really be kind of in a hearing distance of a person to benefit from a certain awareness, to really share more knowledge than with other people on the floor or on another floor, because you can really feel and hear what this person is doing. So if the person is on the open floor, but 30 meters further, then it doesn't really help. And the noise does disturb people. So that's kind of why I feel that large open areas are not really beneficial, except that they are efficient in a way of putting a lot of workplaces there.
So that's efficient from a cost point of view, but not efficient from a productivity point of view.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And then I guess the other thing, just to make sure I understood what you were saying, you're saying that workers then prefer to be in smaller. If they're in open plan, it needs to be a smaller area for the networking effect that you mentioned. But also within those small areas, it shouldn't be crowded, because crowding means noise and noise means disturbance. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it depends, of course, a lot on the type of tasks that the person has to do at that point. But yeah, originally, we all need our own space. That's also why we see place attachment behavior in activity-based offices. And if it's too crowded, I was surprised also to see that when we offered all kind of options to people and asked what they prefer, that they also don't want to be too isolated on the open floor.
Freud and Cocktails is alluding to the fact that the launch party for the British publication was held at the Freud Museum in London, and we served martinis in a throwback to the Mad Men era, what I call the optimism years following the Second World War, when life in the office was quite blunt and simple. So I chose the Freud Museum partly because I do think that this is a moment of psychological reassessment of who we are and what our lives mean. I think that the pandemic lifted the lid on a lot of latent trends, including the desire that had been there for many years to have work-life balance. And in fact, not only did Freud live and work in the same house in London that has become the Freud Museum, which is interesting as so many of us live and work in the same place now, but also we are craving making sense of this moment. So juxtaposing Freud and Cocktails was a way of saying that we want the best of the office, which is the social side, but where we get that social side doesn't have to be in the old bricks and mortar, but that we are processing and synthesizing what this moment means. And that means we need a bit of therapy for it.
So with that as the backdrop, maybe we could start and ask you, as I said, you're not a property person, which I think makes the book even more fascinating. But where did the idea come? Maybe just a little bit of the history of how you got to write a book on and call it The Nowhere Office.
Well, I'm a management and business writer and an entrepreneur. I write for Strategy and Business regularly, and I've written 5 books before this book, The Nowhere Office. And at the heart of it, I'm interested in what works well and what doesn't work well. And because I'm in my mid-50s, I've worked in a lot of offices and I've run a lot of teams out of offices. I've probably had 10 proper offices in my life, in my working life, and I now have no office. And during the pandemic, during lockdown, I made the decision to jettison completely and forever the small office that my team were in. Now, I should say I don't run a multinational, so my decision to drop the office isn't quite the same as, you know, unwinding enormous leases and commitments and so on and so forth. But equally, I was struck by the fact that we've really understood that cyberspace that William Gibson predicted in 1982 is actually here. You know, $15 billion US a week was spent by American companies equipping anywhere but the office to do work from.
The first reality of the report is that office demand is recovering. I think for a lot of people, they might find this slightly puzzling. I guess the first question is this true?
Well, Michael, it's a great question. The data shows that it is true. What we're seeing with our preliminary 2022 Q1 numbers is that leasing activity is actually up just shy of 40% across the globe. It's about 41% in the United States. So there is a growing demand. And in fact, if we look at net absorption, while it's been negative here in the US and in about half the markets in Europe, the other half of Europe have seen positive absorption in 2021, and most of Asia has seen positive absorption during that time. So there is demand for space, and it is accelerating.
So maybe you could dig into that a little bit for us and tell us what you see as the underlying causes for that.
Yeah, I think there are, you know, 2 big ones. One is we're in the midst of a booming job market. We actually have more office workers around the world today than we did at the beginning or right before the pandemic occurred. And so there's across the 10 largest economies, there are 2.7 million more office workers today than there were at the beginning of 2020. So even if we take pretty generous reductions in how much space those people need because they're more agile than they might have been in 2019, that's over 300 million square feet of office space needed to house all of these people. So the job growth is a big part of that. And office sectors, number 2, are really taking a disproportionate part of job growth right now and moving forward. So sectors like the tech sector, which has made up about a fifth of U.S. Leasing activity during the pandemic. You have financial services as well. And then, you know, life sciences and healthcare are growing sectors, which obviously create demand for lab space and for medical office space. But additionally, they're taking on a greater share of office demand. Before the pandemic, it was accounting for about 9% of space, and now it's 13% of space being leased.
Leadership was already changing. We were already focusing on new ways of thinking and about leadership and new ways of developing it. The pandemic has accelerated that. I think we were moving from a very 20th century view of leadership in which leadership's about structure, organizations are about structure, leadership is about a position, a senior position in that structure. Leaders were seen as the person who had the answer. And I think we're now moving to organizations that are fluid and agile and networked. Leadership is something you need right across the organization. And leadership takes place through purpose, through coaching, through relationship. And actually, leaders are often the person who doesn't have the answer. And when we see leaders be open about the fact they don't always have the answers, that they experiment and try things, you see creativity and innovation explode in organizations. So I think there is a big shift underway. And the pandemic accelerated it.
And just to dig into that a little bit more, because I'm interested in this concept, and I think we need to come back to it in a post-pandemic and what role the office plays. But talk a little bit about what you mean when we talk about psychological safety, the ability to get things wrong and learn from them and that not be the be-all and end-all.
I think that is one of the big shifts that the pandemic did accelerate. Organizations waking up to the importance of psychological safety. So psychological safety, in essence, is the belief that as an individual in a workplace, you are not going to be penalized and judged for coming up with creative ideas, for sharing your views, sharing your feelings, for showing up as you are. Why does that matter? It matters because we are now faced in most organizations with disruption and transformation. It's a complex problem. We don't have the answers. We need people to be creative. Or we're faced with the need to innovate rapidly for customers and for consumers. How do you do that? By being creative and by taking risks and suggesting new things. Every act of creativity is an act of courage because people can shoot it down. So I think psychological safety is in part important for innovation. It's in part important for creativity. It's important for well-being so people can show up and talk about exactly how they are. I think it's one of the biggest characteristics of a 21st century organization that's going to thrive and prosper.
And we were chatting when I was in New York last week, and really where I wanted to start having read your book was with the Wharton study that you reference. And I was kind of amazed that the statement it says that people who are mentored are six times more likely to be promoted. Can you kind of dig into that a little bit and what the reasons for that are?
Yeah, I was staggered by the six times myself. You know, anecdotally, right, I'm not a research person. I think that people who request a mentor are people who take the initiative for their own advancement and are learners, right? I speak about people with a growth mindset in the book. I think people who look to be mentored are those kind of people, so probably more inclined to be promoted because they're actively doing something to be promoted, and mentoring is one component of that.
And I think if we just go a little bit deeper into that, I get that. But then what is happening in the mentoring process over and above what you just said that helps people?
I think the getting an external view that's independent is important. I think mentors will a lot of times encourage their mentees to do things they wouldn't otherwise do on their own. We'll give them a go for it. I mean, particularly, right, there's evidence that men pursue jobs based on potential and women on what they've done, right? So perhaps a mentor helps a mentee see their potential. And then I think the other thing that mentors naturally do is open up networks and make connections, right? And the mentee may be, wherever he or she is, may be limited to, well, you know, I have this linear career path. The mentor may open up the conversation to other alternatives and may also introduce the mentee to people who could open up other career paths.
The classic central business district, which was based on agglomeration, is a dead construct. I mean, we've proven in lockdown that even the most hardened resistance to change, you know, the lawyers, the bankers, have all had to work from home and have been surprisingly effective. You know, billable hours and profit per partner is up, or you know, traders were able to function, you know, given compliance issues. So what can we think about in terms of the city? Well, we think a polycentric city will emerge, you know, multiple centres in effect, maybe nodes based around transport terminals to kind of minimise distance commuting and so on. We think that the kind of nature of the city itself will move. Richard Florida, who's a great commentator in the States, talks about no longer the central business district, but the central social district. And I know the City of London has begun to think about the idea of a 24-hour activated city. So when you do come in for your 2 or 3 days a week, there's more purpose. You know, there is socialization and an active environment and not something that feels fairly dead and is purposeful only for work.
So is that the idea, if you look at London as the example, that the West End of London is kind of already there in that it has a lot of retail and social, let's say, as well as the offices, whereas the City of London traditionally has been that agglomeration of like-minded bankers, lawyers, insurance. So the cities which have those CBDs, which are single purpose, will need to expand. I guess a bit like Wall Street has done in the US, it's become much more of a place people live and shop as well as work.
Yeah, I mean, you look at financial in Manhattan, and it's a residential environment as much as anything else now. And you've seen the disbursement of the banks. I think we should find a different balance. I think one of the big issues with real estate is that mixed use is very rare in the CBD. And if it's done, it's still done in silos. And I think one of the kind of secrets will be true integrated use. One of the things that I can see happening is that you've got residential above commercial, and therefore you can sweat the asset. You know, what is an auditorium by day for the office workers becomes a cinema by night for residents. What is a commercial kitchen feeding office workers in the day is a commercial kitchen shipping deliveroos to apartments by evening. So, you know, property needs to be reimagined, planning needs to be challenged. And we need to get to the idea of integrated use, I think, to activate our cities.
Which I guess the residential above office doesn't seem too much of a stretch, given that we have office and hotel and retail as a combined use in tower blocks around the world. But it seems to be offices have sort of not been part of that trend. And you're suggesting that if they were, that would add to the vibrancy of the areas around them.
Yeah, there's an absolute blurring. You know, hotels are becoming workplaces and promoting themselves quite heavily as places to work. And we should sweat the assets in a very different way.
How do businesses connect with the social sector in a meaningful way? I mean, are there programs in place that companies can sign up to, or is it sort of hard graft of people like you knocking on doors, getting people to understand what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I think it requires what I like to refer to as alchemy. I think you do need brokers who understand the business sector very well and who understand the social sector, because otherwise you get often a mismatch of opinions about how each other can interact. And my organisation, the Social Business Trust, which I started 12 years ago now, was as a culmination of my life's work, of that interaction, that space between the two, and what can happen if you bring them together. So that's an art, not a science. And there are different organisations that you could reach out to. You could also have somebody within your own corporate who had a clear understanding of both sectors and could try to bring those two together effectively. But you've got to find the charities that are open enough to the corporate sector for it to work, as well as having a real push and drive within the corporate sector to want to do this and to understand the benefits it will give them to their employees. So I do think it's not a case really of just saying to people, oh, you can have a day off a year or 2 days off a year. You go find the opportunity yourself. You know, that's great. That's a wonderful thing to do. And a lot of people have charities that are very close to their hearts, and that's all good. But this is something different. This is really trying to understand the needs of the social business, the charity, and really understanding that skills that the business people have that when brought together will really be effective.